This episode of Sports with Friends is brought to you by Fume, the number one natural way to quit smoking. If you know anything about me, you know how anti-smoking I am. My parents smoked for so many years, and I hate to say it, they are still smoking. And I recently picked this up for them. There's a new product called Fume, F-U-M. It's the number one natural way to quit smoking. It takes the benefits of super plants, behavioral science, and beautiful design to make quitting smoking a little easier. What appealed to my parents were the flavors. There are many of them. They dug the cocoa mint, the cozy chai, and invigorate. It's a wooden handcrafted inhaler, a hand-to-mouth replacement. Plant-packed cores studied to curb cravings and taste and smell great. It's no smoke, no vape, no nicotine, and no harmful chemicals. Here on Sports with Friends, we have a discount for you. Just go to this website and type in our code. Our code is SWF, Sports with Friends. Go to the website, www.breathefume.com. Fume is F-U-M. Breathefume.com/SWF. So if you use that code, you save 10% on your order today. I received it, and all I thought about were my parents. If you are a smoker, you need this. If you know a smoker, you can help them out. This is a great gift idea. There's over a dozen unique flavors, so you fill out an online quiz and find out what cores are best for you. It takes 30 seconds. Go to breathefume.com, shop breathefume, F-U-M, and save 10% with the code SWF for Sports with Friends. Fume, the number one natural way to do what I've been begging my parents to do, quit smoking. And now stay tuned for Sports with Friends. Hey everyone, welcome to another edition of Sports with Friends. My name is Seth Everett. We're so glad you're with us. Thank you for the ratings, the reviews, and remember, that is how iTunes markets these things, so do us a favor, leave us a review. If it's very negative, just do it on Twitter. Don't do it on iTunes. We are going to be reviewing a major tournament that I thought was better than most, and I usually love the U.S. Open. But for some reason, this one was really, really riveting. And it was riveting from start to finish. And we are going to talk about that U.S. Open here. It is also week two in the National Football League. But you know what? Since this podcast is also about the U.S. Open, there was a gambling element about that, too. We welcome in the head odds maker at BovadaSportsbook.com, Patrick Morrow. With that wild finish in the U.S. Open, with both finals being total shockers, what did that mean for Bovada?
Underdogs, we're howling at Bovada. That's always good for business, Seth.
Indeed we will. All right. The last time this gentleman was on this show was episode 164. It was right after the U.S. Open had concluded, and it was a wild controversy involving Serena Williams, and it was a first victory for a then-rookie unknown named Naomi Osaka. Her name will definitely come up in this podcast, but Mark or nay is a longtime sports broadcaster who has worked with the U.S. Open in the past. He has covered the U.S. Open for, I want to say, decades. And he is kind enough to give us a couple of moments as he rejoins the podcast. And I think the audience has quadrupled since the last time he's been on. So hopefully he gets some good feedback from this. Mark, welcome.
And hello. Four times for four times the audience, my friend. How are you?
It's good to have you back. You were at the Open a lot this year. You were also at the 2021 without fans. Let's start there. How big a difference was it, and how COVID conscious were they?
Oh, it was obviously a stark difference going from virtually no one in the crowd except for media people who were on scene and employees who were enjoying a lunch break or after their shift, who were invited to go in and sit and watch the matches, obviously all masked up in 2020. This year, though, full attendance. Everyone had approved vaccination, and it was very COVID conscious.
But was it strict, like every day? Like if you were a multiple, if you went to multiple days, did you have to show it both times? How strict? I guess that's the question that the NFL raised in week one was they were like, hey, you vaccinated? Yeah. Okay. Bye. And it, like in some stadiums, they didn't really give a crap. You understand what I'm saying? The protocols are all in place, but how did they enforce it?
For the media, it was really simple. When you picked up your credential, you showed your vaccination card, they put a little sticker on your credential, and that was the end of that. You didn't have to be checked every day. For anyone who was attending with a ticket, whether it was a general admission or for any of the stadiums or a suite, you were checked every time you went through the turnstiles. So if you were there for all 14 days, you were checked all 14 days. And if you didn't provide positive proof of vaccination, you were not allowed entry onto the grounds, which of course is ironic because not all the players were vaccinated. They had different rules to follow. And we were very fortunate, the tennis community, we very fortunate in that no players that we know of were actually defaulted from the tournament once it got underway because of a positive test.
That's a good sign. The tournament, though, was still in the aftermath of the Tokyo Olympics, and they were also without three major stars, Rafael Nadal, Roger Federer, and Serena Williams. That was the theme going in. Obviously, you know, you're not one thing I want the audience to know, Mark Hernay is not a bullshit artist. So the words Raducanu and Layla were not in his vocabulary when the tournament started. But was the theme of the tournament, in your estimation, about who wasn't there as opposed to who was?
You know what? I think the first couple of days there was a focus on here, especially day one. Here we are, first time in forever without Rafa, Roger, and Serena. But it very quickly turned into who is here and what stories are developing. And I have to correct you on one thing. Emma Raducanu was on my radar going into this. Now, I will say, in a million years, no, seriously, because she had stormed through the qualifying without dropping a set. She actually had a pretty good summer, made a nice little run at Wimbledon, et cetera, et cetera. But I can't sit here today on September 14th and tell you back on August 30th that I had any confidence at all that she would make it to the quarterfinals, the semifinals, the final, and win the tournament. That was never a thought, but she was on the radar, the very outskirts, okay, if you will, of the radar.
Well, I, because you are who you are and you're a stickler for grammar and pronunciation, Mark and I both have done the Olympics for Westwood One. And at the Olympics, they teach you, and I've talked about this on the podcast before, you have to ask. If the name is Smith, you ask. You don't assume ever, and you never get a pronunciation wrong. I heard throughout the tournament, Raducanu and Raducanu. Did you notice? Well, you're there, so you're not as you know, television conscious. But I heard, depending on who the broadcaster was, you heard different pronunciations. What is the official Mark Hernay authorized pronunciation for Emma?
Let me tell you, here's the beautiful thing about the advances of technology over the years, Seth.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that the WTA website and the ATP website actually have the players themselves
saying their names?
Announcing their names, awesome, so that everybody can hear. So that when Emma says, hi, I'm Etta. I'm sorry, let me try that again. Hi, I'm Emma Raducanu. Then we know it's Raducanu and not Raducanu or right. Raducanu or anything else. And the same thing with the men's champion, we should mention, Dmitry Medvedev.
Medvedev.
He calls himself right. Medvedev.
Right.
I got news for you. I'm going to call him Medvedev.
Right. If his mama call him Clay, I call him Clay.
Right.
That's the rules. Yeah, my other pronunciation was Tsitsipas. Did I do that right?
I think he might call himself Tsitsipas, but yeah.
Tsitsipas?
Your pronunciation will pass.
we'll pause.
How's that? Is that okay?
Well, you know, on the Hall of Justice podcast, I made sure that everybody who referred to the film, it's Shang-Chi, not Shang-Chi. Right. And, you know, our American instincts are Shang. Like, it's not a disrespect, but it what happens. And one of my favorite stories was the soccer guys, the ESPN people who called the Euros. They were talking about how when they're calling a country, that the people watching that are usually from that country, and a mispronunciation is a great offense. And so Richard Deitch, who was doing the podcast, says, well, how do you learn all the names? And he says he plays FIFA, the EA sports game. Because on there, Derek Ray gets it all perfect because he has multiple chances. You know what I mean? Right. Like, it's a recording. So he plays FIFA and he'll put specific teams so he hears the names, how you're supposed to say them. And I thought that was... that was pretty hysterical.
Let me tell you one quick funny story about the pronunciations. So Stan Wawrinka wins the championship a few years ago, right? U.S. Open. Well, he himself would flip-flop between how people should say his name. For years, it was Wawrinka. For 1 year, it was actually Wawrinka. And then when he came to the U.S. Open, he went back to Wawrinka. So the entire tournament, I called him Stan Wawrinka.
Right.
I call the final, which lives on in lore. You know, if you're waiting in the queue to come down the midway from the 7 train or the LIRR to get in through the West Gate at the tennis center, you will hear the replay of me calling that match. Stan is the man. He wins his first U.S. Open, et cetera, et cetera. And I called him Wawrinka. My boss gets in touch with me in November of that year and says, we need to redo the match point call from the championship because we're going to have it as our answering machine, outgoing hold music, et cetera. And you need to change it to Wawrinka. So I literally had to come back and sync up the natural sound of match point and redo the call, where I then called him Wawrinka. And of course, by the time the next U.S. Open came around and people are on the queue waiting to get in at the West Gate, the replay is playing and they had gone back to the original Wawrinka version.
Oh my God.
But that's that's what happens.
And, but it happens. And, it, you know, because it's international, you have to respect it. It's something that a lot of people don't always realize. You know, that's the part of it. Like, we think about it. And, you know, a lot of times in sports, you have people from other countries. Well, there's people from other countries watching and listening. So need to know that. More on the 2021 U.S. Open in just a second. But first, let's talk about college football and the NFL. Week 2 in the NFL, week 3 in college football, with the head odds maker at Bovada, Patrick Morrow. And Patrick, let's start with the U.S. Open for a second. I'd like to meet the person and have them on the show, the person who bet a long-term future on Emma Raducanu or Layla Fernandez. There's no stinking way. And then you had the guy going for the Grand Slam and the record in majors and everything, and he was upset. This is what makes you love sports.
You know what? It was a wild tournament. On the women's side, of course, you had the Canadian Layla Fernandez just really coming out of nowhere, beating a lot of talent along the way. It wasn't like when Eugenie Bouchard made her run a couple of years ago at Wimbledon and the bracket just kind of broke for her. Layla was beating legitimate quality players in front of her. And then on the other side, you have a qualifier. She did not lose a set the entire tournament. And, you know, I was told afterwards that she actually spent some time in Canada growing up. So I'm going to make a claim to both of them and just say, you know, how great was that tournament? How great was that result to see two, you know, just so young girls play at such a high level like that? You love to see that because it gives you really good hope for the future of the game. When you see this passing of the torch to two young players like that, that will be around forever.
All right, don't forget, all the college games can be found at BovadaSportsbook.com. There's NFL action as well. And again, maybe it's just we're drinking the Kool-Aid, but it seemed like week 1 in the National Football League was some great games. Let's take a look at Sunday's games now. The Los Angeles Chargers, I'm still getting used to saying that, against the Dallas Cowboys, who, even though they lost in week one, they lost to Tom Brady and company. Let's not call a spade a spade. I mean, this is a situation where they're going to go into Los Angeles in that gorgeous new stadium, and there could be an interesting matchup there. This is a compelling game to watch.
This is probably I think this is the best game of the 425 slate on Sunday.
You totally just jinxed it.
You know what, Seth? If I have jinxing powers, then I'm gonna have to quit the podcast and use them for good or evil, depending on how other people see it. I'm not a big jinx guy, but I will knock on wood here just in case. So, folks, you can't see that. I did give the old Pat Morrow knock on the desk, but. I do think, I don't even care. It is going to be a great game. I'm putting that out there. I'm not one that traffics in absolutes, but today I will, just to counter the jinx factor. The Chargers in this game, Seth, they are 3-point favorites at home at Bovada Sportsbook. And you know what? This was a team last year that was just brutal in one-score games. The Chargers were a team that were right there, often with the lead late in the fourth quarter, and you could chalk it up to coaching. You could chalk it up to, you know, a new quarterback who's maybe not sure how to finish these games, But I will say the Chargers on paper were much better than some of their results last year. And, I think that factors into the fact that they are this home favorite against the Cowboys, who looked great against Tampa. There's no moral victories in the NFL, but if you're Jerry Jones and the Cowboys, you gotta think that you gotta be pleased. You gotta be thrilled, really, with how good your offense looked against the Tampa Bay D that quietly finished the season last year as one of the better defenses in the NFL. Looking at that, only last thing I've got to say and why I will personally lean Chargers is that I heard an offseason story about Justin Herbert, and he was asked about shopping carts and, you know, people who don't put them away. And he just really came down the, no, you put the shopping cart back. As someone who worked at a grocery store in my youth.
Oh, okay. I see where this is going now.
You put the shopping cart in the sign row. You don't just leave it in the parking lot. And right. that goes for everything else in the grocery store. That, to this day, Seth, if someone leaves fresh packaged meat or something that'll spoil in like the cereal aisle, nope, I gotta go put that back. That is wasteful. That is, and Justin Herbert is someone that respects polite society, knows how to be a part of polite society, and that is a man that I can root for. And you know what, especially if I'm comparing him against someone that's gonna claim a HIPAA anytime someone asks him how he's doing.
Again,
I'm going with Justin.
That's not a thing. HIPAA is not a thing.
No, but saying HIPAA and not knowing what it means is apparently a thing. So, you know, we have to put those disclaimers out there. All that to say, yeah, Chargers 3-point favorites at home. Cowboys getting a little bit more of the money. The highest over-under of the week. It's currently sitting at 55 and about 70% of all bets on that over. So we're expecting a lot of points in that 425 game, Seth.
Another thriller, like we mentioned, the Baltimore Ravens losing in Vegas to the Raiders. They come home for the Sunday night game. How about that? Back-to-back primetime games for the Baltimore Ravens and Lamar Jackson against Patrick Mahomes and the Kansas City Chiefs. It's a small line and another intriguing matchup. Again, NFL, you're doing it right.
What a fantastic Sunday football game this is going to be. On paper, no jinx. We buy into this at Bovada. The Chiefs are currently 4-point road favorites in this one, and about 80% of all bets are on the Chiefs. It's really a tough game to get a read on. Now, looking at, and this is always the problem with NFL, because it's small sample size. We overreact week to week. The Ravens' offense looked sloppy against the Raiders. I know they put up enough points, but it didn't look like Lamar Jackson was too settled. If the Raiders D is making you feel uncomfortable in the pocket, I'm a little bit concerned about what you're able to generate offensively long term. Having said that, Lamar Jackson has always shown in the past that he is one play away from being 80 yards downfield for six. So you do have kind of like that high variance offense, which is very difficult to model for, but you do have to expect that, boom, things can change in an instant. And then on the other side, of course, you can say all those things and more about Patrick Mahomes. He can do it with his legs. He can certainly do it with his arm. The best quarterback on paper in the league, if you're asking the one and only Pat Morrow. And that is why they are road favorites in this game. Again, the over-under just slightly below that Cowboys-Chargers game. It's sitting at 54.5 right now at Bovada. And the action's a little bit more split on that one. So a little bit more hesitancy, maybe not as much expectation of points as Cowboys-Chargers. But again, an absolute banger in that Sunday night football slot. NFL, like you said, Seth, doing it right.
And then the Monday night game, the Green Bay Packers, who have to be smarting after they're just getting blitzed against the New Orleans Saints there in that game at the neutral site in Jacksonville. The Packers are 0-1 playing host to the Detroit Lions, who I thought played better. I'm surprised at how big this line actually is.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, Seth, because for the vast majority of last week's opener, the Lions were getting crushed by the 49ers. So a lot of that Lions damage, and, you know, God bless them, because they came back and covered the spread and all these in-running spreads. I think the 49ers were as big as 21.5 point in-game favorites at one point at Bovada, and a lot of players were stacking those Niners bets on top of each other with each increment that it went up. So we were certainly thankful that Detroit got those garbage time points to help make it look a little bit more respectful than it was. And you know what? I was kind of thinking, you know, Stafford, Goff, doesn't matter. Same old Lions. They might get those garbage points for you. They might start scoring when it doesn't matter at all. But it was tough to really figure out, you know, to me, it seemed like the same old Lions. You know, defensively, their struggles. Offensively, their struggles. It seems like they hired a high school strength coach as their head coach. A very manic, excitable fella. I don't know if the X's and O's are there, but we'll certainly wait and see. As for the Packers, yeah, absolutely destroyed by the Saints and Jameis Winston in their week one matchup. You know, they had some poor luck early on, as the Packers had some interceptions in the red zone that took points off the board. This is a very difficult one to really get a read on. But like you said, the Packers, 10.5 point favorites at home right now. And what we are seeing right now is, compared to all the other games on the board, which is surprising for Monday Night Football, less has been bet on Packers and Lions than any other game so far. So I think bettors are kind of signaling to us that they don't really have an idea of what to make of this game either. You know, if it's Aaron Rodgers and a motivated Aaron Rodgers, they're great. They're one of the best teams in the league. They were the third biggest favorite before their week one shit kicking. And, you know, so there is this reasonable expectation that, okay, the Lions will be a good palate cleanser for them. That, you know, if you're going to figure things out, a full week plus an extra day by playing on Monday Night Football and having the Detroit Lions as your road opponent, you couldn't do much better than that. Again, Packers 10.5 point favorites, over under 48 right now at Bovada.
Week one really was great, and our thanks to Patrick Morrow, the head odds maker at Bovada. Looking forward to week two, and we're going to do a podcast on Red Zone because it is really, really outstanding. But back to the U.S. Open now, and let's rejoin our conversation with Mark Ernay. I'm not going to lie, women's tennis is so much better than men's tennis. But there's a theory out there that a lot of this has to do with the attention spans.
Wait, I don't want to challenge you, but what do you mean by better?
I find the women's game a heck of a lot more compelling. It was wide open. And even though there were favorites like a 1 seed, a 2 seed, a 3 seed, they weren't locks. The men's side, what I find with the men's side is I think the matches are too long. And what you wind up doing, you go down this rabbit hole when you're watching a men's match, is especially if they split the first 2 sets, you have another 2 hours to go. And that's a huge investment. Whereas in the women's side, whoever wins the first set is now serving, you know, is going for the match. And it's more of a NCAA tournament feel. I find the women to be more interesting interviews. This is just a personal thing. This is not a, you know, I'm not sitting here saying women's tennis is better than men's tennis. I find it that the women's game is a lot healthier, and there's so many interesting storylines, whereas the men's side has a couple of good storylines and really one dominant player.
Do we want to take up a debate about this? We could be here all day.
Yeah, go for it.
First of all, I think the women's game is easier for most fans to follow because of the simple. Now, they hit hard, but obviously they don't hit it as hard as the men do. And so their points may drag out a little longer, but there is more moving side to side, up and in, whatever the case may be. I think on the men's side, you know, where you will have in some matches, think back to Djokovic and Zverev, I believe it was in the semifinals, a 53-shot rally. There weren't very many like that, even though we were anticipating in the final on Sunday, Djokovic and Medvedev, that there would be a lot of 20-plus shot rallies. There weren't really that many. And a lot of that had to do with the fact that Novak Djokovic was really playing what for him I described as A minus B plus level tennis, which for the first six matches he played was enough to get by. But in the final against a guy who was runner up 2 years ago in Medvedev, who was really hungry for his first major win, he needed to bring his A plus game, because Medvedev did and Djokovic didn't, which is why the result wound up what it did. Interestingly enough, three sets, 2 hours, 12 minutes, not a hugely long match, Seth. And I think if they had gone five, it probably would have been done in under 3.5 hours, as opposed to looking at 4.5 or five.
It depends. I mean, you get tiebreakers and, you know, some of these games take forever. And look, I'm not racing to get out of there. You know, I have an attitude. It's pace of play, not time of game. You know what I mean? It's not the length, it's the pace. And sometimes in the men's game, the pace, I don't know, it just, I don't find it nearly as compelling. But I do want to ask you, I want to cover the men first, because the men's bracket was about this Grand Slam. And people talk about the Grand Slam, and I'm not going to lie, I wasn't alive for Rod Laver. I remember Steffi Graf, but that's it. The Grand Slam has never been this white whale like the Triple Crown in horse racing. How big a deal is the Grand Slam, and what, other than the record book, what is the great award of it?
Well, let's remember what else Djokovic had at stake here. He came in a three-way tie with Rafa and
for
Roger,
all-time
all
majors,
three of them with 20. I mean, think about that. Three guys playing in the same era have all smashed Pete Sampras's record, which was 14 major titles. They have 20 apiece. So number one, you're working with Djokovic going for that historic mark without Rafa and Roger in attendance. So you're thinking this may be his best chance to do that. You're also talking about a guy who has been so dominant. You know, it's Djokovic up here and everybody else, no matter who we're talking about. And even Medvedev, after winning on Sunday,
called him the greatest.
Still a sizable notch below. And then you've got, you know, the other maybe top five, not even including Rafa and Roger, but they're obviously on that level too, but nobody is at Djokovic's level. And let's also keep in mind, he's got a winning record both against both Federer and Nadal. So in any discussion about tennis GOAT, it's to me, it's irresponsible not to start with Novak Djokovic because of what he's been able to accomplish. So yeah, he's got, you know, 21 career majors, the first Grand Slam completed since 1969 in a calendar year. Those are, you know, that's big enough for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. I don't know that we needed many other sidebars going into the tournament. Like I said, when it started on the 30th, maybe there was some thought about no Rafa, no Roger for the first time in a long time. But, you know, Djokovic clearly was the story. In fact, after he had lost his Zverev in the Olympics, in the semifinals, I went on record as saying that, number one, he'll be a perfect angel. We're not going to have to worry about any behavioral issues like he had last year when he hit the lineswoman with the ball, albeit unintentionally, and was defaulted from the tournament. There were no lines people this year, so there was nothing to worry about there. But I also said, I don't think he's going to lose a set, because I think he will be so locked in. And of course, he goes out in his opening match against a guy from Denmark, a qualifier, and he loses a tiebreak in the second set. So right away, that goes by the boards, and he wound up losing first sets in his last four matches. So much for that. But the fact of the matter is, like
my daughter, my daughter watched it for the first time. She thinks that happens to him all the time.
Well, I mean, the fact of the matter is, like I said, he brought his A minus B plus game to the tournament and wasn't at his optimal level. And a lot of that probably had to do with the wear and tear of the season. You know, Rod Laver's accomplishment, and he did the Grand Slam. He completed the Grand Slam twice, right? 62 before both our times, and 1969, which quite frankly, I don't remember. I was 3 years old. But Rod Laver didn't have the same level of competition or the same grind that Novak Djokovic has had to go through. And I think that's the other part of this, is if he was able to seal the deal on Sunday night against Medvedev, that just would have been so huge an accomplishment that everything else, the 21st career major, the, you know, winning a U.S. Open for the fourth time, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, that just would have been the cherry on top of his goat, if you will, cake.
Djokovic's legacy, I mean, there's no secret, he's one of the greatest. I remember there was, when he hit the linesman or linesperson, I don't remember, was it a man or a woman? I don't remember. It doesn't matter. It's not the point. A lot of people thought that the disqualification, and look, rule's a rule. And I remember talking to you off the air about this, and that the rule's a rule. But a lot of people said that the tennis associations didn't like his standing up and trying to start a tennis players union. And I gained so much respect for him, and I probably liked him more after I heard that. And a lot of people thought that that was backlash, that if he hadn't have done that, that, you know, maybe they would have bent the rules or let him, you know, whatever. A lot of this stuff is arbitrary. So just the idea of does his work with trying to set up a tennis players union tarnish his appreciation within the tennis circles?
I don't think it tarnishes anything any more than if you recall the beginning of his career, when he was like the clown prince and would come out and do impressions of other players. And he used to do a spot on Maria Sharapova.
Yeah.
And she didn't like it. Maria Sharapova fans gave Djokovic a lot of S for doing stuff like that and thought it was amateurish and beneath professional standards. And there was a huge backlash about that. But as he began to get better and better and win more titles and eventually start winning majors, I don't call them grand slams, that all sort of went by the wayside. He didn't have to be the entertainer anymore. He could focus on the tennis because his tennis was that good. So I don't think that stuff at the beginning of his career or the fact that he tried to spearhead this union. And, you know, I'm a union guy, so I'm never going to begrudge anybody that. There are some things that both tours need to take care of. And remember, he's not doing this for himself. You know, when the big three, formerly the big four, and Andy Murray, you know, God bless him, you know, complete hip replacements, he's back out and putting on a show in the first round.
Amazing.
See, now let me ask you, you're talking about the matches are too long. That went about 5.5 hours. What part of that match would you have given back?
I didn't see the whole thing.
Well, go watch.
I wasn't covering the Open the way you are, so I'm flipping in and out. And when I found out that Murray was playing the way he was, I tuned in. So I probably saw the last 90 minutes.
But it was a compelling 90 minutes.
It was great. I'm not saying that no men's matches are ever good. That's not the argument. The argument is, as a whole, the women's draw is just more compelling. I
understand what you're saying, and I can't really put up a very convincing argument about that in the limited time that we have here. But I will say, though, that, you know, that first match of the tournament for Murray, the only match
great.
It turned out, was truly compelling drama from start to finish, you know, and dealing with, you know,
Tsitsipas's
extended restroom break, et cetera, et cetera. That became a recurring theme for the rest of the Greek stay in the tournament. How long would he take a comfort break for? And the clocks were running and people had their stopwatches going. And, you know, that took on a whole life of itself. But the fact of the matter is, you know, they don't do stuff like that. You know, Rafael Nadal is not one of the honchos on the Players Council to help himself get ahead in the game, right? He doesn't need help. Roger Federer doesn't do the stuff he does working with other players for his own
future,
ego.
Right, the future.
Yeah, they're paving the way and making sure, you know, if you think back to the start of the Major League Baseball Players Association that you and I are very familiar with, those guys weren't making a heck of a lot of money back then. So they were, yes, trying to help themselves and trying to pave the way for the future generations. But these guys really are trying to help the struggling tour player who, and there was one guy in particular, I can't remember who it was, who showed up for this tournament without a sponsor. And he wound up going to some, you know, very famous tennis shop in Midtown Manhattan because he needed new shoes or he needed his rackets re-rung. And the only place that he could do it, he couldn't get the shoes because he didn't have a sponsor. He had to go shopping at a store in the middle of the tournament. So they're trying to help that kind of player at that level who is a tour player, doesn't have to qualify or maybe sometimes does, but they want to make sure that they have better accommodations, better working conditions, and you know, better opportunities to make some money as they're coming up and they don't have to live, you know, like so many of us do, paycheck to paycheck.
Yeah, no, I totally understand that. All right, let's transition now. The other major storyline was Naomi Osaka. Did you see the documentary on Netflix about her? And what, if you did or didn't, what was your thought going into the tournament?
I haven't gotten to it yet, but I've heard so much feedback from people who think that she is a hypocrite in how can she have a press conference to say, I don't want to do press conferences anymore. Yeah,
we did a whole episode, Kavitha Davidson.
And then, you know,
on.
She shows up on the cover of Vogue magazine, which obviously was,
I don't care.
Was shot.
Is one thing does
long,
not have to do with the
long
other.
Long ahead of that. Right. And, you know, goes to the Olympics and lights the flame in front of the entire world. How can you be an introvert and light the flame? Again, it's all nonsense to me. I haven't seen the documentary. I have every intention to get to it eventually.
Well, in the documentary, again, you know, just for the audience, the documentary was filmed before the French Open incident where she didn't do the Zoom. That's the first thing. The second aspect of this whole thing is whether you saw the documentary or not, the criticisms that she has received are ridiculous. We did an entire episode on Simone Biles and Naomi Osaka during the Olympics with Kavitha Davidson. And we just addressed Osaka. I am a huge supporter. She can say and do whatever she wants. You know, what my question to you is, clearly she's not at the top of her game. And from a purely clinical tennis aspect, that's where I think it's fair to criticize. It's fair to say that Naomi Osaka is not at the top of her game hurts nobody but her. Right. It doesn't hurt me. It doesn't hurt the fans. People, the tennis will move on. If she wants to continue to be the best, regardless of the notoriety and the media stuff that goes with it, Mark, she could retire tomorrow. I wouldn't mind it. Not everyone is cut out to be a championship player for as long as Serena Williams did.
Absolutely. And I don't think we're going to see anybody like that again. Because it's such an anomaly, especially in the women's game. I mean, let's think about this. She won her first U.S. Open in the late 90s. And here we are in 2021, and she's still, you know, every tournament she shows up for, whether she's a high seed or not, she is still a threat in whatever condition she's in to go to the final. And obviously she hasn't won a major now since before her daughter was born. While she was still pregnant, she won the Australian 4 years ago. So whether she ever gets to that magic number of 24 to tie Margaret Court, who knows? But the fact of the matter is she's been at it at a consistent level, barring injuries and pregnancies, for over 20 years. Yeah. Naomi Osaka won her first major 3 years ago.
3 years ago.
I don't think she's done, but as you said, she's not exactly at the top of her game. Interestingly, though, let's think about it. If she had been at the top of her game, then she would not have lost in three sets to Leyla Fernandez in the, what was it, the fourth round, the third round?
Third round.
Right. She wouldn't have lost to Leyla Fernandez. And then Leyla Fernandez would never have made the final against Emma Raducanu, who, by the way, wound up beating the young lady, Shelby Rogers, who had knocked off the number one seed in the tournament going in, Ash Barty, who had just come off her Wimbledon championship. So the story wound up writing itself, if you will, because Ash Barty wasn't exactly at the top of her game against Shelby Rogers, who then got waxed by Raducanu in the next round. And then Leyla Fernandez goes to the final after early on in the tournament, if you will, knocking out Osaka. So without those two top names not being in top form, we wouldn't have had the Cinderella final that we did on Saturday.
She said one thing. First of all, I gave her credit because they offered to let her leave the press conference, and she said no, she'll stay with it. And she said that tennis is not fun. She said there's so much pressure that when I win, all I feel is relief, and that when I lose, it's pure sadness.
Right.
That doesn't sound like somebody who's ready to compete.
No, I don't think it's a good
thing. As someone who's covered other athletes in other sports, I've seen that look. And all you do is, you know, is wish the best for them. But what the best is for Naomi Osaka is not this resurgence tour. Like 2022 does not have to be this reclamation project. If she doesn't want to play until 2023, that's her decision. Just like we can't tell Brett Favre to retire. Or Julio Franco. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's not our place in the media. And I thought anybody who criticized her from a journalism standpoint, not the schmucks on Twitter, but the people who are criticizing her, this is her decision. This is her journey. You don't have to watch her. No one's forcing you.
Let me ask you a question, because I don't remember seeing it. What member of the establishment tennis press took her to task?
No, it wasn't. It wasn't establishment. It was the idiots in mass media who don't go to tournaments and don't watch this except for the U.S. Open. Right. And no,
they're the ones who think every athlete who walks the face of the earth owes them a performance that is up to their standards and suits their selfish tastes.
Right. And
that's not what sports is about. It's never
correct.
Been that.
Correct. But what I'm saying is that have you had an off-air conversation with her? Is she just a normal person? She's really a kid. And is she just a normal kid who internalizes this stuff? And when she flips this robotic switch, she's this killer tennis player. But other than that, she's just a normal person, because that's what you saw in the documentary.
Yeah, I haven't had a private conversation with her, but I know several people who have. And the consensus is that just as she has mentioned, especially over the last several months, she is painfully shy.
Yeah,
she is an introvert. And if not for this remarkable skill of being able to play tennis better than virtually every other woman on the planet, we probably wouldn't know who Naomi Osaka is.
Right.
But she has this gift, and she understands the responsibility to put that gift to use. And listen, she, you know, had a platform last year, albeit in an empty Arthur Ashe Stadium. Every match she played there,
she wore different masks, and she had
seven different masks for seven different causes. Right. And that was her way of making a statement to show support for the causes that she believes in. And again, whether you like it or not, there is such a thing in this country as freedom of expression and freedom of speech. And unless the tennis powers that be were to say you're not allowed to wear these masks, which they didn't do, and they probably would have been very wrong to do, and would have been called on the carpet virtually universally if they had done something like that. That was her way of calling attention to things that she believed in. Her way of calling attention to depression and anxiety was to tell people, albeit, you know, very last minute before the French Open, I don't want to sit for press conference. Essentially, I don't want to sit for a press conference after I lose a match. Which she has every right to say, but of course, you know, the WTA and the Grand Slams,
it was handled.
They have every right to say, no, you have an obligation to sit in press. But listen, you know, there have been players over the years who have met that obligation and just sat in the chair in front of the assembled media. Well, I was thinking more along the lines of tennis, with their arms crossed. And if you asked a yes, no question, all you got was a yes, no answer. And Marshawn Lynch did his thing, which is, you know, that'll go down in history as the first of its kind and maybe the best of its kind. I'm just here so I don't get fined. And that's, you know what, Naomi could very well have done that, pulled it off. I think people would have been upset about it. The tennis establishment wouldn't have been thrilled.
But social media would have loved it.
Well, social media, some. Let's remember, and I thought it was funny. You were talking about this with my class yesterday when we had you on. What I always tell people is that social media has given everybody a voice, but it doesn't give everybody a brain. And so this is, you know, you have to weigh the information that you're getting. You should use it. I think everybody should. I should trademark it. but the fact of the matter is, you have to consider the source of the information. And if some people aren't happy that Naomi Osaka won't do a press conference, so be it. And if they don't like that she's wearing 7 masks for 7 matches, again, so be it.
It's your choice. You don't have to like it, but she can do it.
It doesn't have an impact on your life.
Exactly. All right.
Like so much else in the world.
All right. Let's get to the heart of the matter. Leila Fernandez and Emma Raducanu. First, let's talk about Leila. Nobody knew who she was until she beat Osaka. By and large,
that is correct.
Yes. I have two very off the beaten path critical questions of her. And I have to preface this with, I know she turned 19 this week. So I'm not breaking her down like I break down, you know, Curt Schilling and Randy Johnson in 2001. Like, I'm looking at this a little differently. Number one, on the court, this thing with the jumping up and down, this like jogging in place, there's no science that will tell you that wasting that kinetic energy is a good thing. I can remember Carney Lansford would not stop shaking the bat when he was in the batter's box, and people told him, you're crazy, you're out of your mind, that's going to hurt you in the long run. Is someone encouraging that? How is that her way of focusing? And did you ascertain anything? And was it as weirdly off-putting as it was to me?
You know what? I listen, you know, I've played tennis since I'm 7 years old, which is a really long time. I started with a wooden racket. That's how old I am. I'm never going to tell anybody, and I'll never play at that level.
You hear the
obviously.
Clicks going off the podcast.
But I'm never going to tell anybody how to go about their own business. If you have a way to prepare for a point to try and keep yourself loose and focused, I can't stand here and say you shouldn't be jumping up and down. Listen, there are players who historically have rocked back from side to side. They twirl their rackets. Djokovic used to be famous for bouncing the ball. How many times? 17 times between serves. Everybody's got their own peccadillos. And you know what?
Victoria Azarenka famously, you know, she was the one of the first to really to the moans. And I remember when a reporter, and I wish I knew who the reporter was, when I'm sitting in the press conference and he asked her about it, and she just goes, why does it distract you? Victoria Azarenka is literally my favorite interview.
She's great.
She also, the other one was, did you feel the pressure as the match wore on? She said, have you ever gone through childbirth? That's pressure. I can listen
story.
To Victoria. She's also one of my favorite follows on Twitter. She's hysterical.
Victoria Azarenka. I'll tell you a quick story about her.
Yeah,
I watched her. She played in the girls final of the US Open. It's almost 15 years ago now. She played in the girls' final against the young lady from Newport Beach, California, who my cousins had grown up with. So I was locked into that match. And Azarenka destroyed her. And I came off the court, and the first thing I told anybody who would listen is, this young lady is going to win a Grand Slam inside of the next 2 years, which she actually wound up doing in doubles or mixed doubles. And she didn't win her first singles slam. There I went and said it instead of major, until she won back-to-back Australian Opens. But she wound up a Grand Slam champion or a major champion. And yeah. So I kind of nailed that one off to the side a little bit, she's but I great. Still hit the nail at least on part of its head.
She's great. You know, it's very funny. I find her fascinating. But anyway.
She used to have Red Boo in the crowd. I think they were dating for a while.
Last thing on Leyla Fernandez.
Yes.
Her post-game interviews. Now, again, she's 19. This is not meant to criticize, but what I always remember about young cocky athletes is they take the Mariano Rivera tact, like just act like you've been there before. And she was like, when she was saying, you know, we put on a show and I just want the fans to know I'll put on a show again. And it's not about Naomi. It was about me. And it just, I just wanted to rein her in. And what I loved is I just thought Raducanu had a demeanor that was more, I don't want to say attractive, because what Leyla did was, Leyla was like, somebody wanted to knock the chip off her shoulder. And you don't want to feel that way about an 18-year-old girl.
I think that if that's who she is, okay, then we shouldn't want to stifle that. If she's being genuine, and I expect she was, then why would we want to rein that in? Let her be how she is, right? Medvedev wins a match. In fact, I think it happened last year. It must have been the year before when he went to the final, and it was probably earlier in this tournament too, where the crowd at Armstrong was giving him grief all match. They didn't want him to win, and he won. And in his post-match on court, is talking about how you, the crowd, booing me all night actually gave me energy and the will to want to win just for you people. And he was trolling the crowd. He did it two years ago when he went to the final. He did it, I think, earlier in this tournament. I wasn't there for that match. And he wound up winning the championship. And, you know, obviously the crowd in attendance on Sunday night, 23,000 strong, the vast majority was rooting for history and wanted Djokovic to win. And in fact, there were more nole, nole, nole chants than I've ever heard before. But they also appreciated, come the end of the match, when Medvedev had sealed the deal, they appreciated the fact that this guy has paid his dues and finally has his first major title. And he got it at the expense of arguably the greatest of all time. But no, I don't think, you know, when Medvedev was trolling the crowd, again, this is how he feels. This is who he is. I don't think we should rein that in at all. Let them be who they are.
Okay. And like I said, I wanted to put the context in it because I don't want to sound like I'm one of these assholes, you know, that's ripping 18-year-old kids.
Well, let me ask you a question. Would you rather have that, or would you rather have a certain newly inducted baseball Hall of Famer who never gave us anything of substance press conference?
I like the Jeter. I can handle Jeter. My favorite Derek Jeter story, since he got inducted into the Hall of Fame.
How do you know I'm not talking about Larry Walker?
You're not. Larry Walker. I got a great Larry Walker story. Larry Walker used to hand out the mail. He didn't like the fact that they would have interns handing out the mail, and there were people that were getting on them. And he would literally come in a little, like a half hour before stretch, and he would literally go into the mailbag and start dishing out everybody's mail. That's what I remember about Larry Walker. I covered every game of Larry Walker's MVP year in 97. Derek Jeter, my favorite story of Derek Jeter is I was working with the Mets, and the Mets and the Yankees were playing at Citi Field. And I went into the visitors clubhouse to get Derek Jeter on the Mets pregame show. And I walked up to him and I said, "Hey man, how you been?" And he says, "You haven't been around at all." And I said, "Yeah, I took a job with the Mets." And he had one leg down. He was tying his cleat and he looks up, raises his eyebrow and just goes, "Really?" That's my favorite. That's my favorite Derek Jeter story of all.
Well, I think one-on-one he was fine, but in a group scrum,
he didn't give you anything. Look at Ash Barty or look at Kerber. Like they're personable. They're fine with the interviews, but they're humble.
And they're also not teenagers anymore.
No, but that's
and we don't remember what they were like because
I want to meet. I want to see Leyla Fernandez in 5 years. I want her to stop jumping up and down and just do better interviews. Those are my two things. Emma though, do you agree with the fact that she had an easier path to the final than Leyla Fernandez did?
Well, it was made easier, again, by the fact that Shelby Rogers beat Ash Barty.
Right.
It was made easier by the fact that the highest seed she faced was Bencic in the quarterfinals, number 11, but Bencic. Only because
Bencic, yes,
coming off her Olympic gold medal, she had beaten the former French Open champ Swiatek. By the way, there's another name you want to talk about pronunciations, Iga Swiatek, who, when she first came out, we all called Swiatek or Swiatek or Swiatek, and some even called her Iga. Story for another day. But obviously, Raducanu's route was a lot easier because of what happened.
It's not to her detriment. It's right. But she had an easier path.
Right. And so, she didn't have to face Karolina Pliskova or Pliskova, whatever you want to call her, because Sakkari, not Sakkari, had beaten Pliskova in the quarterfinals. So again, she plays an 11 seed and a 17 seed to get to the final. And then she plays Leyla Fernandez, who did her the favor of beating Sabalenka in the semifinals. And Sabalenka, I keep waiting to break through for another major.
Oh my God, that was
fantastic stuff.
I'm telling you, the women's matches, all of these matches that you're referring to, they were sit on the edge of your seat, but I don't want to keep having this debate. The women's draw was so gripping. It was amazing.
But again, think about the route that Fernandez had to go through. She beat Osaka, former champion. She beat Kerber, former champion. She beat Svitolina, who's again, on the verge of getting there. And then she beat Sabalenka. So all of these would have been potential finals opponents for Raducanu, who, again, highest seed she played was the number 11.
Okay.
So, yeah, she had an easier path.
All right.
Let's think about this. We're talking about the main draw. She had to go through three qualifying matches, too.
Well,
so
right.
she won 20 sets of tennis over 3 weeks and didn't lose any.
In a row. And
I don't care who you're playing. If you can win 10 matches without losing a set anywhere, even at the, Vanson Park Summer League, pretty cool.
I was going to say, we couldn't do that on a video game.
I've never done that.
But how does the mechanics, how does a player suddenly become that dominant? How does that happen? How technically, as someone who has called these matches, as someone who has covered this event as closely as you do, how does someone just literally put their game together to such a level that it goes from pretty good tennis player to a champion in a matter of weeks?
You remember Daniel Murphy?
That's what you're comparing it to? That scumbag? That homophobic, disgusting human?
I'm not talking about personality or anything off the field. I'm talking about
my
how
Leyla
he caught lightning.
My Leyla criticisms are now nothing compared to that.
Hang on.
Daniel Murphy...
I'm talking about the fact, my friend, that he caught lightning in a bottle late in 2015 and parlayed it into a multi-year contract.
Yeah, but he didn't do it right out of the
free agency.
he didn't do it right out of the minors.
No, and listen, and it's not like Emma Raducanu is playing challenger events. You know, she's on the main tour.
No, but she's 18. She hasn't been doing this long enough.
Right.
That's the one funny thing about their interviews when they talk about all the years of preparation. I'm like, right. How many years? What are we talking
well,
about?
Since they're probably 5 years old. You know, think back to Tiger Woods on the Mike Griffin, the Mike Douglas
Another great
show.
Documentary. Yep.
Anyway, my point is, just like Daniel Murphy caught lightning in a bottle 6 years ago for the Mets in September and October, this is what happened with Raducanu, is that she caught lightning in a bottle. She won the first qualifying match. She gets a little more confident. She wins a second qualifying match. She's feeling even better. And a third, and then she's into the main draw. And we see what she does as she slices like a hot knife through butter through this main draw of the U.S. Open. We don't expect it, even going back to her very first match. But the fact of the matter is, you know, she won in the opening round. I think it was Stephanie Vogel, right, who was a lucky loser who wasn't supposed to be there. So she gets a break there, no pun intended. She beats Zhang, who wound up winning the doubles championship with Samantha Stosur. She plays a Spaniard, 41st ranked in the world, Cerevis Tormo. Again, she's not taking on the cream of the crop. Maybe in the fourth round, she would have had Ash Barty and it would have been a different story, but Shelby Rogers beats Barty in the third round. So now it's Raducanu and Rogers. Shelby had nothing left in the tank. She was more spent for that fourth round match than Djokovic was for the final the other night against Medvedev. So confidence, and you get some breaks along the way. And that's exactly what happened. And she wound up parlaying it into, you know, this unprecedented, this unexpected, and maybe the most surprise. I mean, let's face it, she's the first qualifier ever to win a major. It's never happened before.
Crazy.
So will it happen again? I would think that anybody who's got a dream of trying to qualify for a tournament is going to, you know, be spurred on by the fact that as Gary Cohen said when Johan Santana got the last out of his no-hitter, it has happened. And because it has happened, there's no reason it can't happen again, right? The Red Sox showed us in 04 when they came back from 3-0 down against the Yankees in the ALCS. Anything can happen. So here we go. We have a first qualifier winning a major. Well, another one at some point. It may take another 100 years. Who knows?
As someone who... The U.S. Open is one of my favorite events. You know, it's a favorite event. I'm not the biggest fan. I don't have the history of covering it that you do. I'm not. The comparison's not the point. It felt to me as we wrap this up that this tournament was incredibly gripping, and the wanting at the end of a night, you wanted to know when the guys were playing next and you couldn't wait. And maybe it's the return of fans. Maybe it's, you know, the baseball season's boring. I don't know what's going on. Was this 2021 US Open especially great, or was it just, this is what the US Open is and I'm just gushing over it?
I think that the storylines developed to make it more exciting than it might. I mean, let's face it. If we had the top four seeds in both the men's and women's singles draws into the semifinals, no matter how they got there, it probably would not have made for compelling drama, right? Even with the fans back in the stands after a year away. But the fact that we got the stories that we did, and remember, we started this off by talking about no Rafa, no Roger, no Serena for the
right
time in,
which is why
years.
I started the podcast out. Exactly.
Right. But thinking that, you know, this is going to be a letdown because the three legends aren't there, I think this tournament lived up to, and the only thing that would have been better, I think, for the tennis fan or the tennis establishment is that if Djokovic had won his 21st major, completing the calendar Grand Slam, and if Serena had been able to tie Margaret Court with her 24th major. I think those are the only two bigger stories that we would have gotten given all the other drama that we had over the course of the what really turned out to be 3 weeks, because we have to start, like Emma Raducanu did, with the qualifying going back to the week before the main draw started on the 30th.
Yeah, but qualifying to me is like preseason football and spring training baseball.
Well, except that the results count.
No, I understand.
They count.
I understand. How can people find you online and where can they hear you?
I am on 1010 Wins Radio and the Odyssey app and 1010wins.com. You'll find me every morning at various points doing sports reports. I am on Twitter at Mark Renay, MarcRenay. How else? Let's see. Check the want ads in the post office.
He's great, dude. You're awesome, and you know your stuff, and you're the perfect person. When this tournament was over, even before Djokovic had played in the final, I said I have to do this week. I had to recap this tournament. This tournament has literally been holding my attention. It is the thing, you know. The first week and a half, every time I was sitting at my desk to work, I had it on. I have like three monitors here, and one of them always had this tennis. And college football was starting and the NFL starting, and I'll get to all of those things. I just thought this was really fun. And I'm not going to lie, my 13-year-old took an interest. And this was the first time she and I watch hockey together, but this is the first, but I shoved hockey down her throat. You know what I mean? Like I introduced her to hockey. This was her friends. And at first it was the friends, and this is something, you know, having a 13-year-old daughter, first it was Layla and Raducanu. That was the hook. They wanted to see these kids because they're close in age.
Right.
And then it was Djokovic. And I think the friend group decided that he was handsome. And I got that sense that they were really pulling for him. And I was just like, why do you care so much?
It was right. Really. Forget about the historical context.
Right.
Let the cute guy win.
Right. And she's like, this is so sad. He's losing. And I'm like, what? Who are you? I didn't understand. But I loved it because anytime, you know, I don't force anything. I don't force Prince or superheroes or sports down their throats. They are individuals and they like what they like. But the idea that I can watch this tournament with her, like I've already promised her, I'm taking her next year. Like there's no question. If my 13-year-old daughter is interested, and I think maybe that's why I'm more emotional about it than normal time, but I thought this 2021 U.S. Open was stinking phenomenal.
Well, the next step, my friend, is to get her to the park and out on the court and start playing a little bit.
Yes, yes. That is Mark Renay. Thank you for listening, folks. Thank you for subscribing. We appreciate it. Next week, we will continue. Oh, next week, I can even tell you, Damon Bruce from the Bay Area from 95.7 The Game is scheduled to join us for episode 318. Thank you for listening. This is Sports with Friends. We'll see you next time.
If you want me to stay, I'll be around today to be available for you to see. I'm about to go, and then you'll know for me to stay here. I got to be me. You'll never be in doubt. That's what it's all about. You can't take me for granted and smile. Count on days I'm gone. Forget reaching me by phone. Because I promise I'll be gone for a while. When you see me again, I hope that you have been the kind of person